Okay, so where does real power in a country actually lie? I mean, is it all concentrated at the center? Or, do the states, the people in those states, have a bigger say than we sometimes think?
That's really the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's this constant push and pull, this balance of power debate that's been going on in the U.S. basically forever.
Right, since day one.
Exactly. And in this deep dive, we're really going to jump into the history of that whole debate. We're focusing on this idea of sovereign states within the U.S.
Okay.
We'll be looking at, the documents, the arguments from back then, trying to get a handle on how states and the federal government have interacted. The core idea we're exploring is that the people working through their states hold some fundamental power.
Yeah, fundamental and maybe lasting power. And this isn't just like academic history, right? It's about understanding how this whole concept of state sovereignty shaped the country's founding, how the Union itself was formed. And we'll look at some, frankly, fascinating times when states really well pushed back.
No, definitely.
And it all loops back to how we as citizens, maybe right here in Deer Park, La Porte, Pasadena, can actually make a difference today on a local level.
Precisely. That local connection is key.
So let's get into it. Where did this whole idea of sovereign states even start?
Well, you got to go right back to the Declaration of Independence. It wasn't like one single announcement for everybody.
Right. It was colony by colony.
Exactly. Each one declared itself a sovereign and independent state. Justice Chase later pointed this out from that moment. These states were basically acting like independent governments, no outside control.
Sovereign and independent. That sounds, well, powerful. What were they actually doing? What kind of powers did they have?
They were doing things we normally associate with, fully separate countries.
Really?
Well, the Declaration itself says each state had the power to levy war, conclude peace, and contract alliances. And it wasn't just theory. Think about this. Virginia, on its own, ratified a treaty with France in 1779.
Wow. Okay. So Virginia acting like its own nation, essentially.
Pretty much. It shows how they saw themselves back then, distinct players. It really highlights how much power was at the state level, which, suggests even local areas could wield real influence.
So, okay, they were acting like mini nations, but what technically was a state in their view? What defined it?
Good question. A few key figures laid it out. Chief Justice Chase described a state constitutionally as like a community of free citizens
Right.
within certain borders, with a government based on a written constitution, and crucially, the consent of the people governed.
Consent of the people, got it.
And John Marshall, another huge name, said something similar. He called a state a distinct political society, separate from others, able to manage its own affairs, govern itself.
Right, so defined territory, its own government structure, people agreeing to it, makes sense. Where does sovereignty itself fit in?
Ah, sovereignty. John Taylor of Caroline had a really clear take on it. He basically said sovereignty is the will to enact, the power to execute.
Will and the power.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's not just wanting something, it's having the actual muscle to make the rules and enforce them. And the argument was this ultimate power didn't just sit with the state government buildings or with every single person individually, but with the people as organized states. The sovereign state really meant the citizens acting together within their state.
Okay, that's a critical distinction. So these independent sovereign states then decide to form a union. How did that work? Did they just give up that sovereignty?
Well, the first attempt, the Articles of Confederation, that document has the states very, very clearly holding on to their individual sovereignty explicitly.
Yeah.
Then, when the Constitution came along, it's super important to grasp that it wasn't created by, like, the American people as one giant blob.
No.
No, it was formed by the states acting as sovereign bodies.
That really flips the usual narrative, doesn't it? Not top down.
Absolutely. James Madison, in the Federalist Papers, he hammers this home. He says the Constitution was established between the states, so ratifying the same. He even talks about 13 sovereignties making the decision.
13 separate decisions, basically.
Yes, each state had to hold its own convention, debate it, and vote yes or no.
So they came together, but they didn't just dissolve into one thing. They held something back.
That's the core argument. People like John Taylor again, and later John C. Calhoun, they argued really strongly that sovereignty, well, it's like integrity. You can't just give away part of it.
Interesting analogy.
Yeah, they drew a sharp line between delegating certain powers that belong to a sovereign
Like coining money, maybe.
or taxes.
Exactly. Those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Delegating those powers to a new federal government versus surrendering the underlying sovereignty itself. That ultimate authority, they said, stayed with the people in their states. That sovereignty is why they could delegate powers in the first place.
And you can see traces of this structure in the Constitution itself. Oh, for sure. Look at Congress. Every state gets at least one representative, right?
Right.
Regardless of size.
Yeah.
And think about things like the extradition clause states agreeing to return fugitives to each other, or the original clauses about returning people held to service or labor. Those were agreements between states.
Right. State to state stuff baked in. And the big one everyone mentions, the 10th Amendment.
Ah, yes. The 10th. Can't talk about this without it. It's pretty plain language. Powers not specifically handed to the federal government and not prohibited from the states.
Belong to the states.
Or the people.
Exactly. It was basically the states that ratified the Constitution saying, okay, just so we're all clear, we're keeping everything we didn't explicitly give away. It reflected their understanding of retained sovereignty.
Okay, so the foundation is states started sovereign, formed a union, believed they kept that sovereignty while delegating powers. But it wasn't smooth sailing, right? Challenges came up pretty quick.
Oh, yeah. Very early on, you see clashes where people felt the new federal government was maybe getting too big for its britches. Like what?
The Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798. Big controversy. Many saw these laws as direct attacks on free speech and states' rights.
And that led to?
That led to the famous Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. This is where you get the Doctrine of 98.
The Doctrine of 98. What's the core idea there?
It's essentially the states asserting they have the right, even the duty to step in to interpose was the word they use.
Interpose, like get in the middle of.
Exactly. Get in the middle of things if they believe the federal government was doing something unconstitutional, something beyond its delegated powers. It was the state saying, hold on a second.
We need to check this. Okay. Any other early examples?
Definitely. The Chisholm v. Georgia case. This was about whether an individual could sue a state in federal court.
And states didn't like that idea.
Hated it. Georgia and Virginia resisted fiercely. They saw it as a total violation of their sovereignty being dragged into federal court by a private citizen. Unthinkable to them.
So what happened?
Well, that resistance directly led to the 11th Amendment to the Constitution. Yeah, which basically limited that kind of lawsuit.
Yeah.
It's a really clear example of states pushing back and actually changing the Constitution to protect what they saw as their rights.
So they use the amendment process itself.
Mm-hmm.
Were there like physical standoffs or just legal fights?
Mostly legal and political, but tensions were high. Look at the Olmstead case around the same time, early 1800s. Pennsylvania and New Hampshire basically defied federal court orders about prize money from captured ships during the Revolution.
Defied the courts.
Yep. They argued the federal courts were meddling in their sovereign affairs. It really highlighted the friction between state power and federal judicial power right from the start.
These early fights are really telling. It shows this wasn't some settled abstract theory. It was playing out in real time.
Uh-huh.
So moving forward in history, how did this state authority idea feature in some of the bigger conflicts?
Well, fast forward a bit to the Embargo Act crisis, early 19th century. This really hit the New England states hard.
Because of trade.
Exactly. Their economy was based on shipping and trade. Jefferson's Embargo Acts shut that down to punish Britain and France, but it devastated New England.
Well, how did they react? Did they just complain?
Oh, much more than complain. States like Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, they didn't just say it was bad policy. They argued it was unconstitutional.
Invoking that principle again.
Yes. They talked about the right of states to interpose against usurped and unconstitutional power. Strong language. Some state legislatures passed resolutions condemning it.
So states actively opposing federal law they saw as harmful and illegitimate.
Absolutely. And you see it again, maybe even more dramatically, during the War of 1812.
How so?
Massachusetts and Connecticut flat out refused to let the federal government take command of their state militias for what they saw as an offensive war effort, like invading Canada.
They refused the federal government control of their militia. On what grounds?
Their argument was constitutional. They said, look, the Constitution only lets the feds call up the militia for very specific things. Executing federal laws, suppressing insurrections and repelling invasions. Invading another country wasn't on the list, in their view.
Wow. That's a bold assertion of state control over military forces.
Extremely bold. Then, jump ahead again to the 1820s, the big fight over the Bank of the United States.
Right, the national bank controversy.
States like Georgia and Ohio really resisted it. They tried to tax the branches of the national bank within their borders, basically trying to drive it out.
And that led to court cases.
Big time, like McCulloch v. Maryland. It led to huge debates about the Supreme Court's role. Could the court decide the political rights of states? Critics like Spencer Roan in Virginia fiercely attacked Chief Justice Marshall's rulings that expanded federal power.
So constant legal and political battles, which leads us, I guess, to the nullification crisis. That feels like a peak moment for this.
It really was. South Carolina, 1830s. They were furious about federal tariffs. They felt unfairly hurt the South's economy.
Tariffs again. Seems like a recurring flashpoint.
Very much so. This time, South Carolina, really pushed by John C. Calhoun's ideas, formally declared the federal tariffs null and void within the state. Nullification.
Null and void. So, just deciding a federal law doesn't apply there.
That was the doctrine. Calhoun argued that since the states created the Union through the Constitution,
as we discussed earlier,
right, they were the ultimate judges of whether the federal government had overstepped its bounds. They could nullify unconstitutional acts to protect their reserved powers. It nearly led to civil war, but a compromise was eventually reached.
But the principle of a state interposing was front and center. And it wasn't just Southern states using these ideas, was it?
No, absolutely not. Fast forward again, closer to the Civil War, you see Northern states doing something similar, but for a very different cause.
Which was?
Resisting the Fugitive Slave Act. Several Northern states passed what they called personal liberty laws.
Personal liberty laws. What did they do?
They were designed to obstruct the enforcement of the federal law requiring the return of escaped slaves. They guaranteed things like jury trials for alleged fugitives, making it much harder to send people back south.
So using state law to counteract federal law.
Exactly. States like Massachusetts and Wisconsin were particularly strong on this. Wisconsin's Supreme Court even declared the Fugitive Slave Act unconstitutional, directly challenging federal authority, again citing the Doctrine of 98 principles.
So both North and South used this idea of state interposition when they felt strongly about an issue, even challenging the Supreme Court. Like after the Dred Scott decision.
Yes, Wisconsin's legislature passed resolutions condemning Dred Scott and, again, essentially defied the Supreme Court's ruling, invoking state sovereignty.
It just seems like this back and forth, this tension, is woven into the fabric of American history.
It truly is. I mean, even much later, you can see echoes of these arguments in the resistance to federal desegregation orders in the mid-20th century. It's part of this long, long debate about where power lies and who gets to decide.
So, if we step back and look at this whole historical arc, what are the main things we should take away? What does it all boil down to?
I think the biggest takeaway is that this tension, this dynamic between state power and federal power isn't a bug. It's kind of a feature of the American system. It's been there from the start.
Right.
And crucially, states and the people within those states have historically played a really active role in defining their rights and shaping things, often at the local level. This idea of being an active citizen in your state context. It's got deep roots.
Which brings us right back home, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To why we do this deep dive for folks in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena. Understanding this history, it's not just abstract.
Not at all.
It connects directly to what Think and Act Locally is all about, giving residents actionable information for local impact. This history shows there's a long tradition of people engaging locally through their state and local structures to make change.
Absolutely. Those historical examples, states pushing back, citizens getting involved through their state governments, they offer, I think, valuable lessons. They show how people can be effective locally. Understanding this history can empower residents today, right here in Southeast Houston, to tackle local issues to shape their own communities.
It makes that local engagement feel, well, more grounded, more potent, maybe. So here's the final thought to leave you with. How does knowing this history, this long story of state sovereignty and citizen action at the state and local level, change how you think about getting involved today?
Right. What role could you play in shaping the future of your town, your community, whether it's Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena? How does this history inform your action?
Good question to ponder.
And if exploring these historical roots and linking them to making a difference locally is something you value, please consider supporting our work at thinkandactlocally.com/donate. You'll find the link in the show notes.